Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with op-ed columnist Bill Keller about the emerging or changing nuclear threat.
His argument is not these weapons are so awesome and dangerous and mighty that if we don't get rid of them, we will all die in a nuclear holocaust. His argument is these weapons are so ineffective, so useless, that we might as well just get rid of them.
Leslie Kaufman has notes from the field. The Times' Susan Chira talks about women and friendship.
Women often will talk about it, cry about it, yell about it. So I think that the women's friendships often tend to be a bit more out there.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Well, with President Obama having nominated a new Secretary of Defense, questions are already being raised about America's military might and our plans. And there are three new books that discuss the issue that's always kind of there, but sometimes seems to drop off the radar, and that's nuclear weapons. There are three new books. The first is Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons by Ward Wilson. The second is The Second Nuclear Age, Strategy, Danger, and the New Power Politics by Paul Bracken. The third is Nuclear Iran, The Birth of an Atomic State by David Patrikarakos. They're all reviewed for us by the great Bill Keller, Pulitzer Prize winner, former executive editor of The Times, and now an op-ed columnist. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks.
Okay, so we have the three books. Let's work through them first. They each makes a somewhat different argument about where we are, and also kind of looks ahead to see what possible outcomes may be. So let's start with Ward Wilson's Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons. What are some of the myths?
Wilson's book is interesting. It's short, it's digestible, and it sort of strenuously counterintuitive. And what it is if you strip away all the superficial stuff, is it's an argument for disarmament, but it's a different kind of argument for disarmament. His argument is not these weapons are so awesome and dangerous and mighty that if we don't get rid of them, we will all die in a nuclear holocaust. His argument is these weapons are so ineffective, so useless, that we might as well just get rid of them.
And he even goes back to World War II and the notorious droppings of the bombs.
Right. His myths, I'll give you a couple of them. One of the myths that he talks about is the notion that that these are decisive weapons. These are game-changing ingredients in a conflict. The obvious example being, you know, people tend to think that it was dropping the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki that ended, that caused the Japanese to surrender. There's a pretty strong body of evidence which he pulls together that's not the case. That in fact, the Japanese leadership talked afterwards about the horrors of this mighty new weapon, but that was largely a pretext for them to give up in a war that they were already badly losing. And other factors like the Soviet invasion were much more of a shock to the kind of Japanese sense of possible victory than the nuclear weapons. Another example he gives is, this is a little bit of a straw man. He says, you know, everybody says that possession of nuclear weapons deters reckless behavior. Well, I'm not sure everybody says that it always does that, but he gives some examples. Kennedy knew that the Soviet Union had nuclear weapons. That didn't deter him from throwing up a blockade around Cuba. Syria and Egypt knew that Israel had nuclear weapons. That didn't deter them from invading Israel. The Chinese knew that the United States was nuclear. That didn't stop them from intervening in Korea. So he gives these examples. And again, it's a little bit of a straw man to say that, the one thing that nuclear weapons have seemed to have successfully deterred is the use of nuclear weapons.
Right, right, right. And they're still there as, you know, the deadliest of all weapons. What about Paul Bracken? He talks about a second nuclear age. So there are now more nuclear nations by far than there were in the Cold War period, or what we think of as a superpower struggle.
Right. There are nine now. This is a theme that Bracken is a professor at Yale, and it's a subject that he's been writing about for quite some time, and he sort of pulled his arguments together. And he would say to Ward Wilson, you may be right that these are useless weapons in the sort of old think context of the Cold War, but the new aspirants or the new possessors of nuclear weapons find them quite useful.
North Korea, in
North,
some ways.
North Korea, he points out, uses nuclear weapons every day to extract tribute from, you know, China and other places, which is paid to them in order to keep them from using their nuclear weapons. He has a lot of kind of war game informed scenarios about the different ways that these sort of relative latecomers to the nuclear club use their weapons to intimidate, to give themselves cover, or to provide cover to allied groups. It's a little arcane for an average reader, but pretty interesting stuff.
Well, that leads inescapably to Iran. That's the country we hear about most, we worry about most, and there's the most debate about. So what does David Patrick Karakos have to say about that? Is he worried about a nuclear Iran?
He is worried about a nuclear Iran. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, Bracken in his book devotes a chapter to the sort of what-ifs of Iran, and in the end comes down on the side of, you know, while both options are horrible, he would rather have a nuclear Iran contained and deterred than a Western U.S.-Israeli invasion or attack to neutralize their nuclear weapons.
And you share that view, is that right?
I do share that. I think it's a horrible choice. I think both options are really bad. I personally believe that the one way to assure that Iran eventually gets a nuclear weapon is to invade and blow up their nuclear capacity now. Patrick Karakos does not agree with that. He thinks that a nuclear Iran is by a considerable degree the worst of those two choices. But his real contribution, and I think it's a serious contribution, is not so much on the debate of should we or should we not attack their nuclear facilities, but in providing the history and context so that you sort of understand the mindset of the Iranians, which, if you're going to negotiate with them or apply sanctions to them or attack them, you want to know where their heads are.
All right, know your enemy. And where are they? I mean, where does he come out? He understands the Iranian mind, if there's such a thing, quite well? Or
The answer to that question lies in a long, complicated relationship, almost pathological relationship between Iran and the United States. He points out he's particularly good on the older history during the time of the Shah, because some of the guys who were still around who were running the nuclear program in the early days have talked to him. You know, he points out that we actually encouraged Iran to go nuclear, not weapons nuclear, but nuclear power under the Atoms for Peace program. We strongly encouraged the Shah to do that.
Atoms for Peace, that goes back to Eisenhower.
Back to Eisenhower, yeah. It was his notion that you prevent countries from acquiring nuclear weapons by sharing nuclear energy technology with them, and then in exchange for that, they sign on to various international accords that limit their behavior and open themselves to inspection. And we did that. But we also contributed to Iran's sense of being beleaguered and besieged in a number of ways. I mean, during the Iran-Iraq War, which Iraq started and which was devastating to Iran, the United States kind of sat back and enjoyed the spectacle, which sent a message to the Iranians, you're on your own. And then after 9/11, we invaded Afghanistan. Pakistan, which has contributed a fair amount to the supply of jihadi terrorists, we left alone and treated as an ally. And in the Iranian view, the obvious difference between Afghanistan and Pakistan is that Pakistan has nuclear weapons. So the message it sent was, get nuclear and you get respect. So he's quite good on kind of looking into the mindset of the Iranians. Where that leads him is not terribly optimistic. Certainly does not believe that negotiating a disarmament of Iran will be easy. But he does think that what they want is to be part of the world. They do not want to be isolated. The last thing they want is to be a pariah state. They are proud of their Persian heritage and their culture, and they want respect and inclusion. And that's the opening he believes that we have to negotiate an end to their weapons program.
And does Obama himself and or his advisors, do they have sort of the savvy and the patience and the skill to make this work?
We don't know. They have the right impulse, and it's interesting, you know, that Hegel is getting such flack for his views on Iran. His views on Iran, while they're a little bit to the left of what Obama has said publicly, are pretty consistent with what Patrick Herakos would advise. Don't go in and try to punish them as the sort of first order of business. You know, try to reach out. There is a potential. These people ought to be our friends. And anybody who's been to Iran, which I have briefly, will tell you, it feels much more than other countries in the region like a place that ought to be our friend. There are so many sophisticated cosmopolitan people, many of whom have studied and worked in the U.S., they've sent their kids to study and work in the U.S. You know, they're poorly served by a theocracy. And when you spend a little bit of time in Iran, you come away thinking, you know, how did we end up being so diametrically opposed?
Thanks a lot, Bill.
You're welcome.
That was Bill Keller, who reviews three books on nuclear weapons in this week's book review. Leslie Coffin's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Sam.
Okay, so a fascinating piece of reporting that also involves books. The New York Times, a really famous crime that seemed to kind of symbolize what was called in its day the crisis of the city, the way New York seemed to be this almost anarchic place. And it was a very famous New York Times editor and journalist involved in it, A.M. Rosenthal. Tell me the story here.
Right. So we're releasing last month digitally a book that has at different points been out of print, but which is quite iconic in its time, about Kitty Genovese. And I think we all remember the Kitty Genovese case because it got international attention.
Remind us.
So Kitty was living in Kew Gardens, Queens. She was 26 or 28, coming home from her job.
This is in the mid-1960s, early to mid-60s.
1964, coming home March, a cold, very cold March evening from her job in a tavern at 3 a.m., and she's attacked and killed. She is stabbed to death. The famous case that we've come to understand about Kitty Genovese, largely from the New York Times coverage led by a man you may recall, A.M. Rosenthal, who would grow up to be this paper's very famous executive editor, but who also wrote a quickie book that has been very influential over the years, say there were 38 people. His book was called 38 Witnesses, the Kitty Genovese Case. 38 people stood at their window and watched her be stabbed and die and did nothing.
This is the moment in time we want to freeze. It here is this time of urban strife in the United States. There have been race riots in major cities, including New York. Their crime is rampant. Well, people are getting the sense also of there's a greater drug presence and all the rest. And here is this innocent woman who is murdered with blood-curdling screams, and a neighborhood silently watches. No one lifts a finger. That was the story that was told at the time.
That was the story was told at the time. And A.M. Rosenthal is uniquely responsible, many people think, for that story. Now, the Tabs did cover the crime in the way that they cover a crime.
So the Daily News,
the
Daily
News,
New York Post.
Everyone weighed in. And one of the papers did indeed note that, you know, that she died essentially in a cathedral. People standing around watching her did nothing. But the story essentially died and would have died if A.M. Rosenthal, or so the tale goes, had not had lunch with the police commissioner. He was then Metropolitan editor 10 days later. And the police commissioner said, wow, that case in Queens, really something. 38 people saw it and no one raised a finger.
So the idea is they actually, what, saw it through a window? Or?
Well, the question is what really happened? And that was what supposedly the police commissioner said in passing. And if you read A.M. Rosenthal's book, if you'd read it closely, you would have had some questions. What is he really saying here? But the title certainly implies 38 witnesses. And he talked about this. He always said 38 people knew and didn't do anything.
So they had some awareness that this was going on. It could have been somebody across the street who hears a scream and maybe could have picked up the phone and called the police, something like that. It's not 38 people gathered around watching
Sort of imply that they should have or could have known, right? That they witnessed a crime in some way and could have and should have known. And it turns out that's not the case.
What do you mean it's not the case?
It's one of these things that's become this enduring urban myth. But since really the time of the crime, but really in recent years, recent decades, there's been a lot of work looking at court records, going back, interviewing witnesses.
For this particular case?
For this case. This is a very famous case. We, in fact, at the New York Times, on the 40th anniversary of Kitty's death, ran a piece that poked some real holes in Abe's theory. First of all, the biggest problem with this is that Kitty was not stabbed three times. She was stabbed twice. So he returned once. So he stabbed her once, maybe on the way from the bar to her building.
And by the way, was the assailant ever...
Captured and tried.
He was.
He was. He was a very psychotic man. He said he came out that night to kill someone. He just found her. But so she gets stabbed a couple times. Someone does yell out, "Is everything okay out there?" Someone does yell something out, at which point he flees. Here's where things get tricky. We now know that Kitty then crawled or stumbled. So if you had been looking out of a window, so remember it's 3 a.m. You would have woken up to some kind of noise, maybe. And what do you see? You might see Kitty stumbling around the back of the building is what she did. So you,
back of her apartment building.
Right. So she is not in front of the building when he returns to finish her off. She is very well hidden from everyone.
Oh, so then he came back.
He comes back. So he's scared off. She sort of runs around the building, but she's wounded. And then he comes and finishes her off, but not in sight of everybody.
These are investigators or journalists or whoever going through court records, looking very closely at the testimony. In other words, this evidence was available then.
Right. But you got to remember, the coverage was pretty instantaneous, and his book was pretty instantaneous. It takes a while to get a trial, to do depositions, to all of this. That stuff unfolds years later.
Do we know how quickly Rosenthal
wrote his book? I don't know exactly when the trial was, but Rosenthal's book was out by June. The crime was in mid-March. So he would have had to basically write it in 4 weeks. He would have had immediate evidence, but he wouldn't have had what you get from long-term perspective.
Now, Leslie, was that an important and influential book? Was that a book that was widely read or discussed at the time?
Yeah, I think it's considered in many ways an iconic book. It's hard to separate the influence of that book versus the influence of the coverage, both of which were profound. But I talked to a guy named Kevin Cook, who's writing his own book, updating the Kitty Genovese story. And he, by the way, says at most, there were five people who could have heard what happened, much less seen it.
Now, Leslie, you said something in particular is happening with Rosenthal's book. Is that being reissued in some form by the Times?
The book has come in and out of print. It's always sold out of its print runs. It's been very popular with psychology classes who now study the Genovese syndrome, and they assign the book.
And the syndrome is the witness who doesn't speak up.
The witness who does not speak up. So this book has been very influential in its own way. Generations of psychology students have studied it. A guy named Andrew Blauner, who was Rosenthal's longtime literary agent.
Oh, sure. I hear from him all the time. He's fairly active.
Very active. Really pushed to have this book go digitally. He pushed Melville, which is a small publisher out in Brooklyn, to digitize the book, which they did. And that came out in January. The question is, if you know, as you go reach into your back shelves for nonfiction, which is happening increasingly, people going to the backlists and saying, why not just digitize it and resell it? What obligation do you have to any to update the facts?
Right, because unlike, say, a classic novel by Fitzgerald or Hemingway, the facts or new information can come in. And
right.
There's,
and this is a clear case where new information has come in. Did they owe the readers a foreword that said as much?
Is there not one? Is it's being reissued in its original form, or is that being decided now?
No, they decided not to say a word, to leave it in its iconic form. And when I talked to Melville House about this, their basic answer is, look, it's a process. We go back, get the old books, we put them out. You know, we can't review all of them, and we don't want to be responsible for reviewing all of them.
So when you say review, you mean really reevaluate in some way, reassess?
Reassess or see, you know, we just can't do it. But other publishers said interesting things to me. Some people said you do have an obligation to just put a note, doesn't have to be more than 2 pages, just to give some people some context. But I think my favorite comment on this was a woman named Jane Friedman, who works at Open Road, who's busy pushing backlists over there. She said not to talk about it is a missed marketing opportunity.
Thanks a lot, Leslie.
Thanks.
Anybody who happened to see the front page of the New York Times a couple of days ago noticed that our president, Barack Obama, was surrounded by a lot of guys, and almost only guys. There's a new book, provocative new book, called She Matters, A Life in Friendship. It's by Susanna Sonnenberg, and it's reviewed by someone who knows a great deal about this subject because she's one of the most distinguished editors and writers of the time, Susan Chira, former foreign editor, now on the masthead. And she's also the author of a book about parenting and child rearing and the choices women have to make, especially high-powered professional women. And she's here to talk about her review. Welcome, Susan.
Thanks, Sam.
Okay, Susanna Sonnenberg, let's sort of tell people who she is first, because she's actually kind of an important person.
Yes. Well, Susanna Sonnenberg is the author of an acclaimed previous memoir about her very toxic relationship with her mother. And she is the daughter of the man who edited the literary magazine Grand Street, Ben Sonnenberg.
Which was a quite prestigious, elegant literary publication that was very big in like the 80s and early
Absolutely.
90s. Yeah.
And so she grew up. Her parents divorced when she was quite young. Her mother was quite a character, drug addict, alcoholic, had the kids and men would float in and out. She had this disorganized childhood, but also obviously a very literary childhood. And this, her second book, focuses, I think, in a very inventive and engaging way on telling her life through the prism of the succession of friends she's made and lost and retained.
Women friends.
Women friends. Female friends.
So does this include mentors, colleagues, or just people who've been important to her in a personal way in her life, or all of the above?
There aren't too many mentors. There are women she learned from in one way or another, but not classically mentors as we'd understand them. And what I think part of the promise and interest of this book for women, and I hope for some men, is that it looks very much at the effect that female friendships have as you try to figure out how to plot your life. And I thought that was one of its great insights. So at different phases of your life, as a girl and a woman, you'd say, well, I have choices here. What shall I choose? Or what shall I do? And I think she's very good at saying, hey, I look at this person almost like an older sister friend.
So give us some examples. Who is someone she writes about with particular affection or insight at some phase in her life?
I think there are a couple of characters that stood out for me in the book. One was someone she calls Annabelle, who had gotten married before her, and the young Susanna Sonnenberg kind of looks at Annabelle's besotted relationship with her husband, the fact that they're having sex and there clearly is sexual tension there, the kind of glamorous life where Annabelle is making her husband dinner, invites Susanna along, and then Annabelle has a baby, and Susanna looks with dismay as Annabelle becomes completely besotted with the baby. It's like she watches Annabelle act out life stages before Susanna reaches those life stages.
So what's the age difference between these two women? Are they roughly the same age?
Maybe she's clearly somewhat older. Okay. I don't know how much older. I think that's one example that would be familiar to a lot of women. Another example is...
So that example is, here you are, a younger woman, maybe coming of age, and here's this kind of you get this glamorous idea of the romantic sexual relationship, maybe of marriage, too, of early marriage. And then you see it turn into this very different
thing. Right. And what I found amusing and interesting, having gone through these stages myself, is that, you know, first she's sort of dazzled, then she's kind of repelled. And then she has her own child, and she goes through the same cycle of falling completely in love with a child and reordering your life and your priorities. So it's like someone does a dress rehearsal for it for you. You observe, and then you see if you're going to do it the same way. Another person she writes about, I found, for my money, the most compelling friendship in the book is the woman she starts out with named Pamela, who's been a friend, an adult friend, and they've gone through various periods of being extremely close, sharing lives, sharing confidences, having little irritants that they don't always confront each other about but tolerate, having moments of estrangement or different values, most memorably, as I wrote, when Pamela listens as Susanna confides that early in her marriage she gets pregnant. They've decided to have an abortion, and Pamela's been trying to get pregnant and is absolutely clearly horrified and distraught at this and tells her not to do it, crossing that little line about being prescriptive that can be very tricky between friends.
So she actually says, don't do this.
Yes. She blurts it out.
And is there a moral judgment implied in that, or is she just saying, reconsider, please don't do that, you'll regret it later? Or is there something else is being conveyed?
I think that the emotional power of that moment is that they're, again, at different stages. Susanna gets pregnant easily, and the other woman is trying to get pregnant, another very familiar scenario and an incredible point of tension between women. You know, some struggle with fertility, others don't, and it becomes very fraught. And when you're on either side of that line, you may not have perfect empathy or understanding of the other.
Did they then become estranged?
It didn't separate them. It was a bad moment, and they got past it. The strength of their friendship prevailed, which is very sweet.
Is it possible to say that women's friendships are different from friendships, say, you've observed among men? We're not going to make you omniscient, but
right,
just what you've seen. You're married, you're a mom. Do your husband's friendships or your son's friendships seem different from your own?
You know, of course, it's very difficult to generalize. But I think that women's friendships are more verbal than men's, typically, that there's a lot more talking. And the men I know who have deep and very important friendships often do so less verbally, more hanging out. When they have conflict, they don't tend to talk about it. They tend to withdraw. Women often will talk about it, cry about it, yell about it. And I think that women's friendships often tend to be a bit more out there, and men's are often, but not always, less verbal and more based on enormous loyalty and shared interests, but not always the ability to confront problems. Of course, women don't always confront problems well either. But I think that also women have used, at least in my observation, women have used friendships to help them navigate a lot of life and life decisions. And the men I've observed who have deep friendships mostly have a commonality, but I don't always see them doing the same amount of confiding and searching and questing. You know, this is just an observation, and I'm sure it doesn't apply to everyone.
Now, you also describe, Susan, in the review, some kind of like slightly off-kilter relationships too,
yeah,
right? She was a daughter of two, what shall we say, Epicurean parents who had different relationships.
Yeah.
What about some of that?
I think what's very clear in the memoir, and it's brave of Susanna Sundberg, because she doesn't always come off as very likable or very easy. She comes off as voracious and self-involved in many cases.
Is she highly privileged? Do we get that sense?
Yes, I think that she was quite privileged. She seems to have had quite a privileged upbringing. But I found that less of an issue because she goes through a lot of emotional ups and downs and different life passages. But she talks about some friendships that were quite disturbing or odd. There's some adolescent friendships that were either very intense or very unequal. There's a very sad passage about a friend whom turns out to be enormously emotional fragile and has pretty serious breakdown, who she sort of takes herself to task for not having understood how fragile she was and how much of the attraction was that she was the dominant person. She also takes herself to task for, and this is clearly a direct result of her childhood, for pushing intimacy very fast and for overwhelming
Susanna
people.
Did.
Susanna Sonnenberg
she
realizes
would come on strong.
That she came on too strong, that she wanted an instant and voracious intimacy that made many of her friends uncomfortable and caused some of them to reject her.
Is this a book for someone with a lot of life experience, or might it also be of interest to, well, for instance, I have a daughter who turns 21.
I think that for that age, it would be very interesting, because they are of the age when they're looking at women to see how they've lived their lives and made their choices. So I think they would find it interesting, as well as women like me who have lived through a lot of these passages. Young adulthood, motherhood, weathering a mature marriage. One of the things that I thought was I wished I could have understood more about her life, but the prism of female friendships kind of narrowed the field, was that because she chooses only women, you don't get a sense of couples or her marriage or other important parts of her life. She's narrowed the field, and so she's made that choice. But that means there are things that are in shadow.
Oh, that's interesting, because often in married life in particular, there is this kind of dynamic of couples, and she does – that is
not – She barely touches on that. There's one friend that encompasses that, but it's been much more the one-on-one relationships.
Thanks so much, Susan.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Susan Cher, Assistant Managing Editor of The Times, who reviews She Matters, A Life in Friendships, in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's happening on the lists this week?
Well, the return of some familiar names on the fiction side of things, where new at number two, we have W.E.B. Griffin and his frequent co-writer William E. Butterworth IV. They have the seventh book of their Honorbound series, Empire and Honor, new at number two. Also new on the fiction side this week is a romance suspense writer, Linda Howard, who's made frequent appearances on the bestseller list. Her new book, new at number eight, is called Shadow Woman. On the nonfiction side of things, there's just one new book. It's another slow week in bestseller land. Jared Diamond is new at number three with his new book, The World Until Yesterday.
Reviewed on our cover by David Brooks.
Yeah, it's a book that looks at what he calls traditional societies. It's really kind of primitive societies or undeveloped cultures to see what they could teach Western society, if anything. Really a pretty fascinating book from an anthropological and sociological viewpoint. From a self-help viewpoint, like what can we take from these cultures, it's a little more ambivalent than that. And Diamond himself acknowledges that. He says, you know, our cultures are so different. For instance, they don't have organized government in those societies, but we need it because we have such huge populations that we need some centralized form of control.
Isn't this all premised on a rather huge, and I would be surprised if at all, established assumption that somehow we're more advanced and less primitive than these other societies? Or does he not make that case?
He doesn't make that case. In fact, he says, you know, there are various ways of organizing societies. Here's how they've done it. We all know how we've done it. But he provides kind of a fascinating glimpse into how these other societies have evolved. And it's really a question of evolution. They've formed to deal with their own circumstances and their own requirements. And so
you mean they don't require incidents like the Newtown massacre
or
in New Guinea?
I thought you were going to say Newt Gingrich, which they also don't require. He talked in an interview on NPR. He talked about spanking children as an example, that if we want to find out what effect it has on children to have corporal punishment, we could never set up kind of a legitimate scientific experiment here in the West where for 20 years you assign a group of parents to spank their kids all the time and another group of parents to never spank their kids no matter what, and then compare the results throughout the course of those kids' lives. Obviously, medical ethics wouldn't let you do that here and the logistics. But we don't need to run that experiment because you can look to other societies and see that some of them use corporal punishment as a matter of course, and some of them never do. And you can look at how that affects those children's self-esteem. So he says the ones who are never beat grow up much more confident, much more maybe creative, and willing to explore their own identities. But he also acknowledges that the societies that do use corporal punishment have a need to do it. If if the kid is supposed to be watching the cows and he doesn't and they get out and that's the family's livelihood, that the parents are justified in spanking that kid. And so he acknowledges that the specific needs of the specific societies give rise to the way that they operate, which is why their use in applying some of these lessons to our society is a little bit questionable.
Speaking of the needs that our society instills in some, you've also done some digging around in Scientology, subject of an important new book by Lawrence Wright, which we will be reviewing, and found some surprising literary connections there.
I did. You know, Lawrence Wright's new book, it's called Going Clear, which is a reference to kind of achieving one of the top levels of Scientology where you finally become a true Scientologist, really looks at the connections between Scientology and Hollywood because there's so much overlap there. Everybody knows Tom Cruise and John Travolta, and a lot of famous actors and directors are Scientologists.
And some good screenwriters too, right?
Yeah, well, he really got into this book by writing a profile of the screenwriter and now director Paul Haggis, who had a long career as a Scientologist before he broke from the faith, and he became one of Wright's important sources. But I started wondering, why don't you ever hear about famous authors in Scientology?
Apart from L. Ron Hubbard himself.
Exactly right. L. Ron Hubbard, who founded Scientology, had made his career early on as a science fiction writer. And he wrote a lot for the glossy science fiction magazines, kind of cheesy science fiction novels, before he wrote this book, Dianetics, that mixed science fiction with self-help, and it became a huge bestseller in the 1950s. And I went back and looked. It was published in 1950, in May of 1950, and starting in June, it was on the bestseller list for the rest of that year, for six months consecutive. And then when it was reissued in paperback later, it was on for more than a year in the 80s and 90s. And you hear about musicians who are Scientologists. You hear about, again, Hollywood, which is the focus of Wright's book. But you don't hear about a lot of literary figures. And so I went back and looked. Probably the most famous one that I found who had a long flirtation with Scientology was William S. Burroughs, who got involved right in the beginning. Right?
Boy, there's a poster guy for your movement.
He's an interesting case. So, you know, Burroughs, of course, beat writer, author of Naked Lunch, killed his first wife, mostly accidentally, kind of fooling around. After that, got very involved in exploring his own inner psychology. He rejected Freudian psychiatry. He became interested in Wilhelm Reich's Orgone Box and also in Scientology, all as ways of kind of exploring mind control and learning more about his own hidden consciousness. In 1959, he wrote a letter to Allen Ginsberg saying, "Of course Scientology attracts all the creeps of the cosmos. You see, it works." And he recognized right from the start that there was something a little bit creepy. It made him queasy about Scientology.
What did he mean by "it works"?
In his letters, so I went through all of his letters from the 1960s. He got involved in Scientology close to the beginning in the mid and late 50s. He actually went clear himself, using that term, in the late 60s, in 1968. But already by then, he was questioning the whole premise. He was especially questioning what he saw as an authoritarian impulse, where you just had to answer to whatever L. Ron Hubbard dictated.
Did he ever meet Hubbard? Do we know?
Oh, he certainly met Hubbard. And he spent some time in Hubbard's kind of training center in England. He was kind of a big catch for Hubbard. Hubbard knew from the beginning that you wanted to get big names involved in Scientology. And Burroughs was a very big name at that time. But he never really liked Hubbard. He was much more fascinated with kind of the science fiction trappings of Scientology. There's something called the e-reader that you're supposed to hook up and read your brain waves and put you in touch with a higher consciousness. He was always interested in what he called the technology, but never as drawn to the policy. He said, why should there be a policy at all? And by 1969, after going clear, he completely just disavowed it. Scientology tried to disavow him too and say, no, it didn't count that you went clear. That wasn't real. And he, at one point, he called L. Ron Hubbard a hidden technician and philosopher of fascism, Daddy Warbucks at the helm. And he also wrote to a journalist who was writing about Scientology, "I feel that the assumption that having studied Scientology, I am thereby committed to acceptance of all Scientology policies is unwarranted. I'm not an organization man. No writer can be a member of any organization that dictates what he will say and fulfill his role as a writer. All in all, a point has been reached where Scientology as an organization and I must agree to disagree." And I think that explains pretty clearly why you don't find famous authors in Scientology, because it completely curtails their freedom.
What it doesn't explain is why Burroughs, whose Naked Lunch was, I think, censored, and who was this very daring avant-garde writer in the realm of extreme experiences, and graphic sexuality, writes about L. Ron Hubbard as if after giving it a lot of thought, he's decided, well, maybe he'll go with Aristotle instead of Plato.
You know, it's funny. He also throughout questions Hubbard as a writer. He says, you know, his writing really doesn't make much sense, and he's really a terrible writer, but he's such a persuasive talker. And when you listen to him speak, he starts to make sense. And, you know, reading him, you have to plow through all this banal and inane things, but mixed in with it is some good stuff if you stick with it. And once you hear him speak, it all makes sense. So he gives a sense of Hubbard's real charisma and power, what led him to be able to create what's really a religion now.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.